This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.
I don't know. I think in the beginning, you know, from like the first 5 years, you just got to learn to do the craft, write the jokes, mm-hmm. get comfortable on stage. And then over time, you'll start to see a pattern. You're like, oh, I noticed that they're responding to this better than this. And so I will go there. And then over time, it's like, oh, I guess I got, for me, it wasn't really even being country. It was like a lot of my dad's stories. But then when I moved to LA, they're like, oh, no, but you're a redneck.
Hot breath. Here we go, hot breath verse. Welcome back to Hot Breath, the show where you learn comedy from the pros. I am your host, comedian Joel Byers, and you are the Hot Breath Averse. If this is your first time, welcome aboard. You are now an official member of the Hot Breath Averse. You can now refer to yourself as a Hot Brethren and Hot Sistren, as we have a hot episode today with one of my favorite comedians. So many hot tips you're going to get in this show. This is actually an episode from our Q&A series we've been doing in our Facebook group. We've interviewed dozens and dozens of comedians like today's guest all about the craft of comedy. That Facebook group is on a mission to cultivate the next generation of great comics. And if that's something you're interested in, go into the show notes and join our Facebook group. But without further ado, as there is only one thing left to do, and that is inhale a hot breath with John Reap.
Please welcome Reap to the show, the one and only John Reap, ladies and gentlemen. John Reap.
What's cracking, buddy? Hey.
We made it. Yes, yes. There are sound effects as well. They can hear in the group, but we can't hear on Skype. So
that's fine with me. How are you, bud?
I'm doing great. It's so great to officially meet you via the internet. I've seen you perform so many times here at the Atlanta Punchline in the old and the new one. So it's great to connect with you.
Yeah, that is one of the best clubs in the entire country. It's legendary. So many great comedians have been through that club, old and new. And I'm happy to be a part of that history.
Yeah, and you've had a lot of success. I mean, you won Last Comic Standing, you've been in a bunch of movies, and of course the TV commercial and all that. But what I'm curious about as a comedian, I'm a little over 10 years in now, and people watching, go ahead and comment with questions you'd like John to answer, but I'm going to selfishly open up with my few questions here. You've one of those comics who has like been on the road, forged your skill out on the road. Do you have any favorite like road stories or just some of those like never forget moments, whether with other comedians or just that happened out on that grind that we all know?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'll start in the beginning. One of the first memorable moments of like, you know, when you start off doing comedy, you find your own little comedy club. You go there, you do the open mics, and that's like one level of comedy that you get comfortable with. And then the next level is, well, can I take this outside of this room and do it in another room? Mm-hmm. And the first time I did that was me and another comedian. We went to it was a one nighter somewhere in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. It was a pool hall. And when we were greeted like this, we walked in the door and we walked up to the guy, the manager, and we said something like, oh, hi, we're the comedians for tonight. And he goes, oh, shit, that's tonight. We're like, yeah, okay. He goes, all right, well, let's see here. Let me get you a microphone and like – like he grabs a mic, he grabs a speaker, he puts us in a corner, and he turns the jukebox off, which immediately made people mad. And then he told people to finish up their pool games and listen to us. And so it was not very warm at all. I remember about 15 minutes into my set being threatened by a guy with a pool stick, and and I wrapped it up and just got my $50 and got the hell out of it.
How long into your career was this? How many years?
This would have been like 6 months in, you know.
Oh, dude.
Yeah. Like a guy just brought me with him to do like 15 or 20 minutes before him. And I didn't know what to expect. I mean, I started at one of the best clubs as well. Good Nights in Raleigh, North Carolina is really one of those rooms where they laugh at everything. And when you get used to that and you go out into the real world and you realize, oh, I got to write jokes. Okay, this is tough. That was one of those gigs, yeah.
And what I admire about your career is you've always been like a self-made hustler from the beginning, and that's what I'm all about here on this show in my own career. Is I recently just shot and released my own comedy special that I released through my website, and I know when you were coming up, still working at the news channel, you actually pretty much you did like a 3-camera shoot. Shooting like a half hour that you then sent out to all these different comedy clubs that then led to you actually getting to do comedy full time. But for comedians now in the current climate, do you have any tips for how like comedians can kind of get that self-made grit even in these times and really just create opportunity out of the situation?
It's tougher, I think, in a way for you guys, even though you've got the advantage of, you know, the internet and everyone having a camera on their phone now that's just as good as the cameras I hijacked from the TV.
And the VHS and all that, yeah.
but in a weird way, the technology's better for you guys, but it's also harder to develop, I think, as a feature comedian because it's hard to get work as a feature. I mean, you start off open mic and maybe hosting shows, getting around 15, 20 minutes. But the art of a good feature is kind of, it's harder to come by now because what happens is, you know, headliners today are just bringing their own guys, their own feature acts, people they know, people they've had relationships with in the past. And if not, then the club will just supply a local guy to do 15 or 20. So it's harder for you guys as features to get work, but the technology's there. But that stuff, I would say record as much as you can, you know, your set, and don't be too eager to share it.
Boom.
Because I've seen a lot of guys who have a killer set in front of maybe 10 people, and the audio's bad, the video's not that great, a waitress is talking right next to the camera. You can't really hear. And even though in their minds and on stage, they just had a great set, the audience, you know, on their laptops or on their phones watching this at home, they don't know that. And all they see is a bad video and it can hurt you. I would not share it too quickly. I know it's tough because a lot of times you have the best set of your life and you didn't record it. And then sometimes you got all these cameras in there and you set up to record and you didn't have a great set. So it's kind of like trying to capture lightning in a bottle. You got to try to make both those things happen. And I just see a lot, you know, I follow other comedians on Facebook and stuff. And I see a lot of guys sharing stuff that, you know, I would have waited a little while.
Yeah. Are you seeing, because you've been doing comedy since the mid 90s and even you with coronavirus going on right now, I know you had a trip planned to LA to be like pitching a pilot and do all these shows and everything. But it seems like your strategy is now just doubling down on content with your podcast and all the media you're sharing. Is that the move right now for us comedians?
Yeah, I think it's the move right now for not even during a pandemic. I think, and that's the point I was trying to make and I forgot, was like, yeah, you guys need to be doing, and I need to be doing more than just working on stand-up because the game's changed, man. It's different. I didn't start with the internet. It didn't exist. So I didn't have to worry about coming up with a funny 15-second video every day or something like that. I just had to focus on the performance of and the material and getting on stage. Whereas now, if you're not doing both, you're going to be left in the dark. So you really, really have to create content online, whether it be a show like yours right here, or a podcast, or just coming up with funny sketches with some friends. Find a thing and do both. That's what I would tell people now. But yeah, it's tough. I've been fortunate because during this pandemic, I have been focusing a lot on my podcast and my Facebook presence, and it's kind of fun. Like I have more time to focus on that than I ever have. Mm-hmm. And I think in a weird way, the advantage of this whole thing is I'm getting better at that. And I'm having fun doing it. I've been doing TikTok videos with my mom.
You've been on there dancing.
Yeah. So that's, you know, I'm having fun walking around the block and talking with her and taking questions and working on the country-ish podcast and making TikToks. And it's been a lot of fun. But I'm ready for this to be over so I can go back on the road.
Yeah. And how mindful, just to think of the name of your podcast being country-ish and you being, I won't say typecast, but almost like known as the Southern comedian, and you playing the Hemi guy where they cast you as like, we're looking for someone that's white trash, but yet you're this guy with 3 degrees. So it's like, where, yeah. is there any conflict with like how your brand has evolved, or is it just something you've leaned into and just like embrace as just natural?
Yeah, it's something that came out of necessity. I didn't even really think of myself as a country redneck person until I moved to Los Angeles in 2000 when people told me, oh, no, you're a redneck. I'm like, but I'm not. They go, yeah, you are. And I go, well, but I know real rednecks and I'm not that. But I sound that way. I look that way. And some of my best friends are that. But I thought like, well, you know, I got to put, I kind of got my feet in both worlds. You know, when I moved, I was in LA 18 years and I had to figure out something to let them know, like, yes, I know I sound dumb to you people, but this is just my accent. This is just how I talk. So I had to develop jokes and material around that just to get past that and get on with the actual jokes and material I wanted to do. So it's something that came out of necessity. I've never really thought myself as one or the other. I'm not a redneck, but I'm not Joe Hollywood. You know, I'm not like some city slicker either. I got to figure out I'm this weird hybrid of both. And I think really a lot of people are a combination. It really depends on your percentages. Like I would say when I lived in Los Angeles, I was like, I'd say like 65% more Metro than Jethro. And then when I came back to Hickory, it's kind of balanced out. I'm a little bit like 50-50 right now, you know, but I think it's levels. And that's why my first album was called Metro Jethro. And this podcast is called Country-ish because I'm kind of country, but not really.
Yeah. Is that something comedians need now more than ever, maybe, with how much comedy there is out there? And for me personally, like my comedy special is called The Trophy Husband. And I've really been leaning into like that brand, if you will. But this is also coming after doing comedy for 10 years. So it's like, I'm not delusional to think I figured out comedy. I mean, I've been headlining and doing more Comedy Zone gigs and things like that lately. But like, I'm just scratching the surface only 10 years in. But is it part of the job of comedy is like, what is my angle in this? How can I stand out from everyone?
It helps. It helps you. I mean, I don't know. I think in the beginning, you know, from like the first 5 years, you just got to learn to do the craft, write the jokes, get comfortable on stage. And then over time, you'll start to see a pattern. You're like, oh, I noticed that they're responding to this better than this. And so I will go there. And then over time, it's like, oh, I guess I got, for me, it wasn't really even being country. It was like a lot of my dad's stories.
Huh.
Like I could really talk about my dad for an hour. I mean, one of the biggest bits I have is a bit about my dad trying to fix a hole in the bottom of a swimming pool by wearing a backpack full of rocks and trying to breathe a garden hose. My dad has nearly died so many times, and I have all these great stories about it. And you know, that was like the first thing I realized, oh, maybe I'm the guy that does dad stories, you know? But then when I moved to LA, they're like, oh no, but you're a redneck. I'm like, okay, well, let's go there then. So I've really just sort of went with the flow, but I think it does help if you have a clear idea of, if you already know what you kind of are, what your brand is. See, most people in the first 5-7 years don't even have the luxury of knowing what their brand is or will be.
Right.
You just get used to being funny and comfortable up there. And then you kind of figure it out over time. But, you know, there are some people who just who never figure that out. But if you can figure it out, I think it will help you succeed quicker.
And you being in LA that long, I mean, who were the comedians you kind of came up with and developed with?
Well, when I first got there, I moved out there in 2000. I worked at the Comedy Store. I knew a guy who was already working there, a buddy of mine named Jeff Richards, very funny comedian. We started comedy around the same time at Good Nights in Raleigh, North Carolina. And he moved out to LA about 6 months to a year before me. And so when I went out there to visit, I just crashed with him, and he was already working at the Comedy Store. And he says, well, come here, I'll get you in the Comedy Store, we'll get you a job. I was checking IDs. They make you, yeah, I was like a door guy.
Yeah.
And they make you a non-paid regular, which means you can check IDs, you can work the door, and then if no one shows up and they need someone to run up on stage, that's your time. And so you just kind of fill in the gaps. And then you do a showcase for Mitzi Shore. That's Pauly Shore's mom, who runs the store at the time. She would approve you as a paid regular or not. And then you would you'd be like in that sort of weird graduating class. So in my graduating class, I guess you could say, the times I were hanging out there in the beginning, you had Jeff Richards, you had Steve Byrne, you had Bobby Lee, Sebastian Maniscalco. I'm forgetting so many people, and they see everybody there.
Yeah,
because it's like the fraternity house for comedians. They've got three different rooms of comedy going off simultaneously, and everyone goes there. Comedians like to go there and hang out, even if they're not performing, because when you're a headliner and you go on the road, you don't get to see the other headliners that maybe you started with, because, you know, it's like ships passing in the night. But when you go to the Comedy Store and it's a Tuesday or Wednesday, everyone's hanging out because they're not working. And then they'll go to the Comedy Store and work on a new set or just hang out. But I mean, you name it, I've worked with them all. Like, I've had to follow Andrew Dice Clay. That was tough. I've worked, you know, shared the same stage with Chris Rock, Dave Chappelle, Pauly Shore, everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody. It's crazy.
What was the, you said the Andrew Dice Clay was tough to follow. What happened with that?
Well, we're polar opposites. And, but I love Andrew Dice Clay. I mean, when I was a kid, before doing stand up, I think I was like 19 years old, he had an album come out. It was a double cassette tape album called The Day the Laughter Died.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, it was produced by Rick Rubin, too, and they filmed it at Dangerfield, or you recorded it at Dangerfield in front of like 10 people that didn't know he was going to be there.
That's right, and he slowly walked the whole room.
Right.
And it's one of my favorite albums ever. I had it memorized, and so I was a huge fan.
Oh, jeez, okay.
I mean, just as a kid, I didn't even think I was going to be a stand-up. I just loved comedy, and mm-hmm. he was one of the guys that, you know, we thought was hilarious, you know. Anyway, now here I am at the Comedy Store, and he's up there, and then he has to introduce me. And he doesn't know me. We've never met, but that's how they do it. You know, each comedian goes up and does 15 minutes and then brings up the next guy. And so he brought me up, and he had just murdered. He'd just done great. And I was like, man, I love Andrew Dice Clay. I'm a huge fan. What if he wasn't from the Bronx or of New York? What if he was actually from the South? What would he sound like? And I started trying to do my impression of Andrew Dice Clay as a Southern man, and the audience was not having it. They're like, no, just do your thing, buddy. It's fine. So it took me about 10 minutes to win him over in a 15-minute set.
Oh, yeah. And that is a lesson every comedian has to learn is, like, do your thing. Don't try to adapt to whatever happened before you. Just do you and bring the audience to you. It's a tough skill to hone.
Yeah, I shouldn't have spent 10 minutes trying to figure that out. I should have made one joke. That's another thing that they do at the Comedy Store. It's almost like a given that whoever is in front of you is going to introduce you, and they might do a jab, they might do a quick little ball bust on you, mm-hmm. and then when you go up there, it's your turn to do that back. But you don't do it for 15 minutes. You just you say one 30-second thing, and then you just move on. That's totally acceptable. I think what I did was just I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I was starstruck because it was Andrew Dice Clay.
That's so gnarly. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So let's get into these questions here. Let's get into some fan questions. I've hogged enough time. But did you work with Mitch Hedberg coming up, by the way?
I did one time. He was the headliner at Good Nights. I think I was the MC or the feature. I think I was the MC. Yes. And he, this was on his downward spiral. You know, he was getting really heavy into drugs and he had sold out shows and did great. But I remember after I came off stage, feature act goes on stage and the manager of Good Nights is like, John, have you seen Mitch? I don't know where he's at. Have you seen him? I'm like, no, I don't know where he's at. He goes, all right, well, if the feature act gets done and he's still not here, I need you to go up there and just do more stuff until we figure it out. I'm like, oh, but I'm out of stuff.
Right.
Because I don't care. Don't come off that stage until I tell you. I'm like, oh, okay. And then I went on stage after the feature act was done. I'm sorry. Actually, he showed up right before the feature act got done and he walked in. You know, I love Mitch, but this is a true story. He walked in with a phone book and he had like powder on it and he was licking the powder off and doing like this. And he's like, all right, get that guy off stage. Let's go. I'm ready right now. Let's go, 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 go. Get him off stage. And they're like, okay. And then he goes up there and murders for 45 minutes to an hour. And then he left. He didn't do any kind of meet and greet. He didn't sell any merchandise. He just bolted. But he was really heavy into an addiction at that point.
Yeah.
And he died probably maybe a year later.
Man. Oh, man.
Yeah. Very sad. But I did get to see him work, and it was great. There was no one like Mitch Hedberg.
For sure. Yeah, I always like to ask people who have been out on the road in that grind like you. Like, I've had Tom Rhodes on here asking him about Mitch as well. Like, he was just one of my favorites, so I always like to know who got to cross paths with him and just connect. So very nice.
I didn't get a chance to connect, but I mean, he was just so far gone, but I did get to enjoy him live. That was fun.
Are there any comics that you've been able to like work with or connect with or learn from where you're just like, I can't believe this, like, I'm at a point in my comedy career where I'm actually coworkers with people like this. And maybe what have you learned from them?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely in the beginning. Let's see here. George Lopez actually came through Raleigh and was very, very nice to me. I was starting to get really good as a MC and a feature. And he was like, damn, man, you got something going on here. You should really think about doing this, you know, for a living, and gave me some advice and told me to look him up when I got to LA and all that stuff. And then same thing with Rodney Carrington. Rodney Carrington came through Good Nights and we just hit it off really good. And then we hung out and, you know, I told him some ideas I had for jokes and he goes, oh yeah, that's good. You should use that. And then fast forward later, I ended up on his sitcom, which is kind of crazy. But yeah, I mean, let's see here. Trying to think, Chris Rock actually gave me a huge compliment one time. This was at the Comedy Store. It wasn't even a compliment. It's more of like he proved me right about an argument I was having with other comedians. Like, me and some other comedians were just kind of hanging out in the parking lot of the Comedy Store, and we were arguing about who we think is the best blue-collar comedian, you know, between Ron White, Jeff Foxworthy, Larry the Cable Guy, Bill Engvall. We were like arguing, and everybody had a different guy. And then Chris Rock happened to overhear our conversation, and he walked up and he tapped me on the shoulder. He's like, "He's right." is him. He's right. And then just went away. So I don't know. There's a lot of people in the beginning you learn from, but then at some point you gotta, you know, you gotta just take it on your own.
And who were you right about? Who did you say?
I didn't say.
See?
I don't want to upset anybody, but here was our argument. One guy said Foxworthy, and I go, well, yeah. He goes, well, without Foxworthy, none of those other guys would have been what they are, because he was the main headliner that started the whole thing. And then one guy said, no, it's Larry the Cable Guy. He's obviously sold so many records and had so many specials, and you know, he's now with Disney. He's the voice of Mater and all this stuff. And I said, well, I think it's Ron White, because he's actually closer to the real deal than the other ones for me. And plus, you know, he likes to have a good time like me. So Chris Rock agreed with me, but that's just our opinion.
And no one said Bill Engvall? Is that?
Well, I'm sure one guy did, but I forgot.
Yeah, my favorite Ron White story you have is when you were like opening for him and you had to go pick him up from the hotel, and he answers the door with a joint and he's like, "We gonna be late," and that's just.
Yeah, man. I mean, I think everybody who's ever worked with Ron White has one Ron White story like that, because he's a real deal, man.
Oh, dude, when I got to host for him one time at the old Atlanta Punchline, and I remember singing the Green Room with him, and I just remember he just goes, if this was 20 years ago, I'd be in here banging a waitress right in front of you. I was just like, okay. And that was like my first time working with a comedian at his level, and I was just like, oh, I guess we made it if he's saying that in front of me. You know, it's, I feel like a comedian now.
Yeah, that's great, man.
So this ties into the first fan question as well. This is DJ Underwood, who says, were there any Southern comedians that influenced you or that were your heroes growing up?
Well, you know, this goes back to my point original. I never looked at myself as a country redneck Southern comedian. Mm-hmm. I happen to be from this area and have this accent, but that's not – I didn't look up to that. I mean, unless you count Andy Griffith, I love the Andy Griffith Show. I love Don Knotts. Those guys are Southern. But, you know, in terms of the comedian, I mean, to be honest with you, the first one that really inspired me was Bill Cosby.
Hmm.
Yeah.
What was it about him?
Well, he made my dad laugh, and I remember – we could watch his special. He had a special called Bill Cosby Himself. And he came out on stage and just told these amazing stories. And it was clean. And the whole family could sit there and watch it and laugh. And I remember thinking, wow, that guy is making my dad laugh really hard. I want to be able to do that. And so Bill Cosby was the first comedian that sort of made me want to try this or think about it, you know, or fantasize about it. And then as I got older, it was, Steve Martin, I loved a lot. And even when I was a kid, you know, a lot of kids would watch Sunday morning cartoons, you know. I would watch Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin movies. Because to me, Jerry Lewis was basically a human cartoon. He was hilarious. And so it was never really like a big Southern comedian. I just happened to like what I liked. Mm. Sorry, I just had text.
No, you're good.
But later on, as I got older and I started realizing, oh, I actually am redneck to other people, and I got lumped into that category, then I started watching the other ones, and then I started to appreciate them. But I didn't grow up that way.
Mm-hmm. Good question.
Like Rodney Carrington to me is one of the funniest human beings on the face of the planet.
And that's what's – I'm familiar with his name, and I know he sells out and kills it everywhere he goes. But he's honestly that's funny. He's kind of like – it's kind of like a James Gregory in that they found an audience and can sell out. But still, most people may have never heard of him. You know, it's like they found an audience and just can kill with it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, Rodney started in like Oklahoma, Texas, and just – you know, it's weird. There are people from Texas who can make a great living and no one know who they are outside of Texas. That's how big that state is. But it's crazy. Yeah, definitely Carrington was one of those guys. He had a lot of sold a lot of records back when people were selling records. You could actually sell music. He had a lot of funny songs. And he was on radio stations nonstop with John Boy and Billy and Bob and Tom and all the big syndicated radio shows. And he just got big that way. He got a sitcom for a couple of seasons, and then that was it. But he still sells out everywhere he goes, anytime he goes there. It's crazy. I see him his tour schedule. I'm like, wow, this is amazing. He's able to keep this up. But yeah, I'd like to find that crowd. I'd like to be able to do that.
Yeah, what do you think the secret is to finding that crowd?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I think it's you got to connect with your fans, and you got to stay in touch with them. Mm-hmm. Like, I think you really got to do a lot of meeting and greeting and one-on-one. Now with social media and stuff like that, you really got to be on top of that game too. I think it's that, and having a different, like, those guys that we're talking about are very good storytellers and not so much joke tellers. And I admire both. You know, I'm like, hey, if you're making people laugh at the end of the day, I don't care how you do it.
Yeah.
But the difference between a joke teller and a storyteller is if you hear a joke one time, then that's it. You know, you might tell that joke to someone else, but you can't keep telling the same joke over and over again because people go, yeah, you just told that or whatever. I've already heard it, you know, but a story can live forever because a good story, it's got jokes in it. It's got, you act things out. There's characters in it. Sometimes it evolves over time and people will say, oh my God, I hope he tells this one again. Because I remember loving that story. I forgot how it goes. It's so long that it's not just one joke. And so a good storyteller can have a career like that, that can tell the same stories over and over again and no one care.
Yeah, Bert Kreischer, a prime example with his machine story. It's like people want to hear it every single show.
Right. That Brian Regan has jokes, stories like that where people want to hear those stories again. You know, and sometimes they get mad if you try new stuff.
And that was your big breakthrough is when you finally told that story of you getting kicked out of the Carolina Panthers game. That was kind of the moment in your comedy where you're like, oh, there's like another layer to this that I can do.
Yeah, that was sort of the whole reason why I had the confidence to get on stage to begin with was that happening. And, you know, it was one of the first things that I talked about that was a story that started with just as a story and not like a series of jokes or one joke. And then over time telling the story many times, you learn the funny parts and you learn, oh, well, there's a joke opportunity in here. And then so you sort of write jokes around the story as opposed to coming up with a joke and creating a bunch of jokes that might lead to a story. It's like, I don't know. That's one of the big, I'm a storyteller guy and I like real things that happen and it's just easier for me. It's also harder for people to steal jokes from you if it's something that happened and is so bizarre and crazy that will only work in a story that people can't take. I could never take Bert Kreischer's machine story because people would, you know, be like, well, that's ridiculous. That's Bert's story as opposed to one joke.
Let's get into the storytelling a little bit deeper here, because that's something as comedians, especially me, trying to like peel back another layer in my comedy and be more kind of autobiographical in storytelling. What is the process behind like, this is a funny event that happened in life, like your Carolina Panthers, but then how do you translate it to stage? That's something a lot of people don't understand is comedy is a new language that you have to translate your life experiences into. So what was the process of this funny thing happened and now it's like a laugh, 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 laugh?
Right. Okay. So for example, the Carolina Panthers story, there's a lot of things in there that I thought were funny to mention in the story. you just got to kind of, like, in your head, you got to tell it to yourself a couple of times. Maybe even throw it on some friends and don't tell them that I'm thinking I would never tell a friend, hey, do you think this is funny? And then try it out, because right away they're like, no. So I would just sort of, like, in random conversation, throw the story out there. And if it happens to you, your friends are going to want to know about it. So you're going to get used to telling this story, because this is a big thing that happened. So in the telling of the story off stage, you got to kind of learn and pay attention to, like, what was funny, what wasn't funny, and blah, blah, blah. And then you just got to take it to the stage. And one thing I found that helps later on, I found out this later on, was sometimes it's better to start with the punchline if it's a long story. So I wouldn't go up there like, oh, so in 1995, me and my friends went to a Panther game. I start the story with, I got kicked out of a Carolina Panthers game for dancing in the end zone with the mascot. And people go, what? Then do you tell the story? It's not like you kind of keep, you grab their attention right away with a major headline. And then you give them bits as you go. Well, here's what happened, you know. Otherwise, if you're just telling a story from the beginning, you could lose people.
Good hook. And then to find those details, is it you just tell it as it happened, and then over time you pay attention to what gets a laugh there and a laugh there? Because you mentioned seeing, be able to add jokes throughout it. Where do you find those?
Yeah, couple ways. After telling it a couple times, you know, it's trial and error, and then after telling it a couple times, you'll listen to what the crowd laughed at, what they didn't, and know that, well, that worked. And then if you record your set, you know, and you go back and listen to it, you can think, oh man, I should have said this. Because sometimes when you're on stage and you're performing it, you're not 100% in your brain thinking of a new approach to it. But if you're outside of it and you're listening to it later, you can really dissect it and come up with jokes that you wouldn't have thought of otherwise. So that's one way of doing it. And another way, over time, the more and more you get and a crowd laughs at something that you didn't expect, and then you just improv a little bit and see where that road takes you. Sometimes that can lead to some comedy gold. Sometimes it can't, but it's trial and error.
Awesome. Yeah. And DJ said, yeah, that's what Bert does with his machine story, is he hooks them in with got involved with the Russian mafia and then breaks it down from there. So, yeah. Yeah, that's gold. Awesome. And listening to the set. Go ahead.
Jokes are different. I think you want the joke. If it's just a joke, I think you want the punchline to be a crazy twist that they didn't see coming at the end. But if it's a story, I think it's okay to sort of lead with the craziest thing and then break it down.
Yeah. And this is actually something I was curious as well. This comes from Trent Babb, who asked, do you rehearse looking at the mirror?
I did at the beginning because I thought that's what you were supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And I was interested to see what I looked like before I had a video camera. But no, that's not, that's really not good, because when you're on stage, you're not looking at yourself. You're looking at the crowd. Yeah, just the other day I watched the movie Joker not long ago with my mom, and, the new Joker, it's really good.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of, the movie, Robert De Niro did as Rupert Pupkin, and I forgot the name of that movie.
King of Comedy.
It's
a Scorsese movie, yeah.
Yeah. So there were some elements of that in Joker, but the point I'm trying to make is, if you noticed Rupert Pumpkin's basement, his wallpaper was a crowd of people looking at him. Mm-hmm. And that's more realistic than looking into a mirror.
So yeah, that is what's interesting. I wonder, because your voice is so distinct, if you were like rehearsing it off stage, because it is more of like how you're saying things adds a whole new layer of humor beyond just the actual verbiage of what you're saying. And that's sure. A compliment, yeah. By the way, being able to elevate your material like that is very challenging.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I always enjoy the kind of comics that that used everything, not just words, but their face, their whole body, nuances. I liked all of it. And then sometimes you don't prepare for that. You just get up there and you're telling a story and you make a face that you didn't think was funny, but they did. And then and it gets a laugh and you go, oh, I can hold that for another 2 seconds. You know, anything to get laughter. I mean, that is the goal for comedians, laughter.
All right. And this next question. Yes, remember, kids, it has to be funny. Funny above everything first, okay?
Right.
Yeah. A lot of the times it's like, I want to have a cool attitude on stage. Well, it's like, well, be funny. Be funny first.
Yeah.
let's see the next question here. This is from Dee Dee, and she asks, of course you want to murder, but don't you think you did your job if only a few people laugh? What makes you say I did good?
Well, if only a few people laugh in a room full of 500, that's not good. But if only a few people laugh in a room of a few people, that's great. So it depends on how many people are in the crowd. But you want the percentages to be more people laughing than not. Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, I would say murdering is 98 to 100% of everyone laughing very hard that they can't breathe. That's murdering. But you can still have a great set and only get about 55% that are laughing so hard they can't breathe. And then that will also make other people laugh sometimes. And they'll feel like, well, why am I not getting this? Why is this guy laughing so hard and I'm not? I don't know. Maybe it's something I'm not getting. But, yeah, I mean, a few people is not murdering. I mean, you can feel good about yourself, but I wouldn't share that tape with everyone because it's not as good. It will never be as good to other people as it was for you because you were in your body when it was happening and you were experiencing all that love. They're just at home, or they're driving, and they're looking at the car, and they're looking at you, and it's like, what? What is this? Mm-hmm. So it needs to be. I feel like that question was from a comedian.
Sure.
It needs to be. If you want to share it and you want people to like it and think you're good at what you do, it needs to be a good quality video. But keep at it.
Yeah, that was something Nate Bargatze said when we did a Q&A with him. Was like, being in New York and seeing a comic like bomb, and he was going to be like, it's all right, man. Yeah, I struggled with them too. But then the comic got off and was like, yeah, that was a good show. And he was like, what? It's like, that was awful. He's like, you bombed. I mean, he didn't say it to him, but he's like, remember him? He said that was a moment for him in his career where he was like, oh, some people just aren't even listening to the audience.
Right. And they're delusional.
Right.
I mean, at the end of the day, you really, I mean, as a comedian, I want people laughing.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's not happening, then I'm not a comedian. Maybe I'm something else and I can make a career at that. Maybe I'm a good public speaker. Maybe I'm maybe I'm good at roasting or something. But if they're not laughing, then that's something different. As a comedian, I want laughter.
As do I. So let's just few more questions here. The next one. Oh, Trent actually had a follow-up on the storytelling with, do you ever find your stories get bigger laughs from the characters' reactions as opposed to your inner thoughts?
Ask me that again.
Yeah, let's see here. Do you find your stories get bigger laughs from the character reactions as opposed to your inner thoughts? So maybe it's saying like, do you find there's more laughter when you take them to the moment and create that interaction as opposed to, I remember this thing happening that time at that place when he said this, you then take us to that moment of him saying it and you make it current.
I think people like it anytime in a story, if you take on the role of other characters, like, you know, people say, oh, this guy does a good impression of George Bush. Well, everyone knows who that is. But if I said, oh, and my dad, and I started getting into what my dad sounds like and what that is, that's a character, even though they don't know who it is, mm-hmm. it's something different than the way I sound now. And you're acting it out. It's another layer in your story. So yeah, sometimes the characters that I portray in the story gets bigger laughs than me telling a joke or another random thing. People seem to like it when I do my dad a lot, you know, when I take on my dad's persona. And it's really not even that close to what he sounds like. I just thought this is a funny sounding thing. So,
right.
If I were doing an impression of my dad and people knew my dad, you'd be like, he doesn't sound like that. But the people don't know my dad, so they just have to believe me. But I think that's what they were asking. I'm not sure if I answered the question.
Yeah, it seems like that's what it is. Like, do you find more like laughter creating characters as opposed to like maybe having like an inner monologue with the audience, maybe type? Like, I feel like act outs and characters add a new dimension to your stand up and make it more of like a show as opposed to like a monologue.
And again, this is just what has worked for me.
Yes.
You know, there might be other people who don't do that and do. And the, I mean, there are tons of people who don't do that and are very successful and very funny. I'm only telling you what has worked for me.
What I love about you saying that, I've interviewed over 200 comedians, and that has been a common theme of it, is like, this show is all about comedy advice, but most comics are like, now this is what worked for me. I'm not saying this is the law, this is how I did it, but it may not work right for you, or you won't, only a piece of it may work for you. Like, there's no one way in this comedy game.
100%. I didn't know that when I wanted to be a comedian, I didn't know I was going to be a Southern sort of country storytelling comedian, because I had no idea how I was going to be on stage. I just knew that I made my friends laugh and I like making my friends laugh. Can I do that in front of strangers on a stage? Let's go for it. And over time, I just figured it out. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's just what worked for me. I don't know. Everyone's path is different. Everyone's strengths are different. Everyone's weaknesses are different. So you just got to figure out what your strength is and then, you know, go for it.
Ooh, that's gold. Figure out your strength and then go for it. How long into your career, because you've been doing it since the mid-90s, and I've been doing it like just a little over 10 years, and I still feel like I'm just like scratching the surface on figuring out this comedy thing. When did you start to be like, oh, I think I'm getting into a rhythm here. I think I'm starting to figure out at least like the basics of this. Like, mm-hmm. How long did it take you to get that confidence?
I got lucky again. I came up during a time where I was able to get a lot of stage time for not being a, you know, New York or L.A. comic. I mean, Raleigh at the time, Good Nights and maybe one or two other spots was the only place to do comedy. But I was doing a lot of hosting, doing a lot of emceeing. So I got a lot of reps in. And I was high energy, way more than I am now. They like, you know, comedy clubs like high energy acts. If you're not, you know, if you're not already famous and don't already have a fan base and you're some no name off the street, they like it if you're high energy, because it makes the crowd engage and everyone has, you know, it's just more fun, I think, for them. But so I was high energy and I got a lot of work. But I think, I can tell you what it was. So I was probably doing, I maybe had 2 years under my belt doing comedy. I wasn't a feature act yet, but I knew I had 30 minutes in me, but I'd never done 30 minutes at one time. I had done 10 here. I'd done 7 here. I'd done 15 here, different stuff, but I've never pieced it together. And it was a Wednesday night at Good Nights. The headliner did not show up. And the club owner was like, well, let's move the feature act to headliner. Let's move John to feature. John, you could do 30 minutes, right? I'm like, you betcha, boss. And so I knew I could. I just had never done it. And it just happened to be, the headliner happened to be a black comedian. And the whole room was all black people. And, you know, that was intimidating for me because I'd never experienced that. And I used to dance on stage. I used to make fun of dancing by dancing. I used to call myself the Hickory Dance Machine. And I would go on stage and do random stupid dances like, you know, shovel, rake, mop. I did my favorite dance I did was one called Any Guy Washing Women's Laundry in the 1800s Dance. Very abstract. Wow. But I had all this. I had it set to music. I had every dance had its own song, and it was all timed out. And to my own credit, I can dance. I got rhythm. And so I went on stage, and I started dancing. And I still think to this day there is nothing funny, nothing funnier to an all-black room than a white guy dancing. And they loved it. And I was dancing. Their faces were going, yeah. And then I got done dancing, and then I started getting in my routine. And they were like, no, no, we need you to dance again. And so I would do a bit, and it would sort of taper off at the end. It was losing momentum. I'd just go, hit it, Paul! Like that was the DJ. Hit it, Paul! And then he'd play music again. I started dancing again. But it did – that was the first time I did 30 minutes – and it was the first time where I got big laughs, and then it tapered off, and I got them again. Like it was a journey, 30 minutes. And it made me realize, oh, I could do this. Mm. I could do this. If I did this again, over and over again, I could figure this out. And that was one pivotal moment that I'll never forget. It's like, okay, I could figure this out. This was not too bad. It was actually really good. And I learned from that. But yeah, that was a big one.
Yeah, big. Yeah, that's a big benchmark for all comics when we do have shows where you overcame the odds and survived. Right. And you're like, oh, this isn't as bad.
Yeah.
Oh, DJ said you have to do a dance video calling out Bert and Tom. You should do that.
Man, believe me, I've already thought of it.
Oh, come on.
There's a their dances are not really... Like, I got to be honest with you, I could dance better than them, but their dances are funny, and they're very highly produced, and they spend a lot of money on those videos.
Yeah.
And let me just tell you, they will out-budget me in these videos. I will not be able to keep up money-wise with the product they're churning out. But if it were a straight-up dance competition, I could do that. But I like to be funny with it, you know? There actually is a video on YouTube if people wanted to see it. I retired my dances. Like one day I just said, okay, I'm not going to be that guy anymore. I'm just going to focus on better stories and better jokes. And I'm getting older and I didn't want to dance every show. And so I did one show at a big theater and I recorded it. I said, this is the last time that I'm ever dancing. And I recorded it and it's on YouTube right now. If you type in, go to YouTube and look up the Hickory Dance Machine or Hickory Dancing Nut, mm-hmm. You'll see it.
How long into your career was that?
It's just me on stage. It's not like, it's not like a music video. It's just me performing in front of an audience that one last time.
How long into your career was that where you're like, I don't want to dance anymore?
Around 2005, 2006.
So about 10 years into it, I guess you were like, all right, enough dancing.
Yeah, I'm done with that part. Nothing wrong with it. I was honestly just getting tired. Like it was exhausting and I was kind of outgrowing it. It looked weirder. I mean, as a young man, it's kind of fun. He's kind of cute. Like, oh, look at that guy. He's got rhythm. He can dance. Not bad for a white boy. And then you get in your 30s and 40s. People are like, oh man, this is weird. Why is he dancing? You know? So
gotcha.
That to me, in my opinion, I felt like I'm just going to be done with that.
And that's what I was looking for when asking about like when you felt like you were getting to another level is like me 10 years in, I'm like, okay, I'm ready to like up the level a little bit. Like my writing's always been there, but now it's like what I want to get more storytelling and more performance. And that, like, I like how you said about 10 years in is when you're like, all right, I'm ready to like reassess what I want to do with comedy. So I'm glad you had that around the same time. So that's reassuring.
I mean, really, my whole career started with dancing. I was dancing at the Carolina Panthers game with the mascot,
That's right,
which
yeah.
got the whole ball rolling. And then I thought, well, let me take it to the stage. I'll show them what I was doing at the Panther game, and I'll come up with other dumb dances. And I had a whole routine about dancing, and I just started getting out of shape. It's like, do this.
Yeah, DJ said you could do it at a trailer park and lean into the low budget video vibe.
Oh, yeah, that'd be good. Yeah, just go out somewhere and do it like well, it's funny, Zach Galifianakis a while back. This is not dancing, but he did he lives in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. He I don't know if he still does, but he's from Wilkesboro, North Carolina, has a farm. And he shot his own music video to a Kanye West song. And that was kind of neat because it was the two opposites coming together, you know, which I thought was cool. And I would love to, if I'm going to do that dance video, and I've thought about it, I've had other people bring it up to me like, oh, you need to call out Bert and Tom.
Yeah.
I would like to. I just know I would want to do it really good, and it would take me forever. And I would have to employ people in editing, backup dancers, all this crap. And I'm like, really, for a 30-second video? I don't know.
But sometimes stuff goes viral just from the phone. Like, you know, a TikTok calling them out may be all it takes to,
right.
You know what I mean? A TikTok with your mom calling out Bert and Tom, and you're both making fun of them in some way. Like, it could be that simple that strikes fire, you know?
Yeah, maybe I'll do that.
And then maybe now you're dancing on stage again. It just comes full circle. Now you're known as the dancing machine.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, maybe this is the time to do that because, in a weird way, I just had a doctor's appointment not long ago. It's just a routine checkup, you know, just happened to be during this corona crisis. Mm-hmm. And he goes, wow, you look really good. He goes, what have you been doing? I'm like, well, I can't go to Planet Fitness anymore because they're closed. But my brother, who is a health fanatic, he's a CrossFit fanatic. You know, he made a gym out of his garage, and I've been going over there. And since I can't go anywhere else, that's all I've been doing. And so this pandemic, I'm the healthiest I've ever been because of this pandemic. So maybe now it is time to bring back the dances.
Well, you heard it here first, Hot Breathiverse. This is where it started. Hot breath. So let's, yeah, just like two more questions here. And we'll get you on and out so you can start rehearsing your dance to take on Bert and Tom. Gregory Hardy says, let's see. Do you have any memories you'd like to share of doing Gator Bowl in 2008? As a University of Florida guy, I was thrilled when I heard you mention it in another talk you did.
Yeah, that was crazy. That is the biggest audience that I've ever performed in front of, like a live audience, human beings. It was the Gator Growl is the biggest pep rally in college sports. They hire big bands. They have big comedians come in every year. I mean, it's been going on. I mean, Bob Hope was one of the first guys to do it. You've had tons of comedians over the years. Big names that you know.
I feel like I've heard Seinfeld talk about it. I think I've heard him talk about doing it. Yeah.
Jim Gaffigan, Seinfeld, you name it, man.
Yeah.
There's a lot of big names, and I'm like, wow, this is going to be crazy. God, I'm trying to think of who the band. The band was big, too. Oh, God, they sing Abra, Abra, Kadabra.
I won't
reach out and grab you. Oh, who is that band? Anyway, they were there. And so I had to go in first, and I want to say it's probably like 35,000 people, maybe.
35,000 people.
Yeah, because they do it. They do it in the football stadium. They have a stage set up in the end zone, and the audience just fills in the seats. So however many people come there for the pep rally, that's how many people. And that thing, you know, it probably holds like 50,000, but it was about 30,000 people. That was a lot of people, but
good night.
The weird thing about it was there was no one immediately in front of you. So I had no one, no crowd, because they had manicured the field for the game. They didn't want people on the field. So no one was on the field. Like, I'm in the end zone looking at an empty field. The crowd is in a shoehorn around me in the stands. And they're yards away. So you trying to look someone in the eyes and have a moment with them telling a joke is not an option. And I remember asking Jim Gaffigan, like, well, do you have any tips for me to do this? He goes, well, just know that the crowd is so big and so far away from you that it takes a moment for the sound to carry. So you'll do a joke and you're probably used to getting laughter immediately, but that won't happen. Even if the joke worked, you're not going to know it for about 3 seconds. So it'd be like, you tell a joke and boom, punchline. And it'd be like in your head, you're going one, two, and the crowd goes, comes back with laughter. But that first 3 seconds is scary because you don't know if it worked and you're just standing there waiting. So what I did do was play to the camera. They had a camera guy close to the stage. And so I would look right into the camera and they had your face on these giant screens behind you mm-hmm. that people in the stands could see. So really you're just playing to the camera guy and hoping that people in the stands are listening and getting the joke. But that was Tim Tebow's last year at Florida State. That was his senior year. And it was really cool, man. They were really nice to me. I had a good time there.
I can't imagine the high after that. Because, you know, killing in front of 300 people, you're buzzing. But 35,000? You must have been high for like a month.
Right. Yeah. It was crazy. It was just one gig. I only had to do 15 minutes. But thank God. I wouldn't have done longer than that. But it was fun. I made fun of Tim Tebow a little bit.
And they went along with it, or did they take offense to it?
Yeah, I mean, I really just sort of, I have football jokes, so it just changed the name.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, because you played football, so.
I played football in high school, and then I got kicked out of a football game, so I've got a lot of, you know, it was easy for me to do that gig. It made sense. I had just won Last Comic Standing, so it was I was at my peak, I guess.
Yeah, and DJ had referenced as well of like your storytelling style. Does it come from being in the locker room and things like that? Do you adapt it from that?
I don't think it locker room had anything to do with it. I think it's more of just you know, that's just what I grew up listening to with Bill Cosby and those kind of people. I don't know. I don't know why. In a weird way, I think it's harder. You got to be more clever to write really good jokes where you can actually go up there and tell jokes and not have to act anything out and just go joke, 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 and that do well. You have to be very clever and very smart and have a great vocabulary and be very succinct. Whereas that's just not the kind of human being I am. So I have to, like I say, play to my strengths, which is making a goofy face and telling a story and being likable and moving around and, you know, that kind of stuff. So unfortunately, I did not acquire that skill, but I admire those who can.
But you have skills other people don't. So, yeah, it's very good overall note from this is to discover what your skill and strengths are and just double down on them. So,
yeah, 100%.
And people are saying the Steve Miller Band was Steve Miller was Abracadabra.
Yes.
So these are two quick ones to end on here, kiddos. Thank you to everyone that tuned in and asked your questions. And of course, thank you to John for your valuable time here. The first one, Jody Carter is, who are your favorite current comics?
Okay, so I use a guy named Brent Blakeney. He opens for me a lot on the road. I met him in Raleigh. Oh, very funny guy.
We did a show in New York together last year.
Oh, very good. Yeah, you're familiar. 6'7" tall.
Right.
So he serves many purposes for me. Not only is he a great comedian and fun to be around, but you know, he's like my built-in bodyguard.
Yeah.
So I like Brent. Also love a guy named Dusty Slay, who's really on fire right now.
Yes.
From Nashville and has been touring around, and I've known him for years, and he's doing really well right now. So those are my two favorites at the moment that people might not know about.
Yeah, and Dusty's been, he did a Q&A, and he also did an interview with us a few years ago as well. So yeah, good dude, great dude.
Yeah.
And a good time, as he says.
Well, there you go. That's an example of a guy who found his niche and is just and going for it.
Right. Exactly.
Smart guy from a trailer park and has the branding with the thing. Like, it's all, like, very smart.
Very smart. But organic. You could tell. Yeah. What attracts, I think what people appreciate about it is that it's authentic. He's not trying to play a facade. Right. It's all authentic to him. And he's just self-aware enough.
Right. It just, it happened organic. Like, you're right. It happened on stage. He just found himself doing that and that's getting an extra laugh. And he thought, well, I guess I should talk about why I do this. And it just became a thing.
Boom.
He didn't think, well, I need a thing. How about this? He just noticed he was doing it and then made that the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. So the final one here, it's kind of a two-parter. I'll combine between John Chappelle and Dee Dee because they're kind of along the same lines. But John asks, can you say hickory?
I sure can. Let me give you the full Monty here. I'm from Hickory. There you go.
And then Dee Dee asked, I have to ask this, but does that thing got a Hemi?
Yes, it sure does. That's another thing that came that just happened and it became a thing, you know. So now I've had to write material based on that. I didn't want to. I was just an actor, a gun for hire, and that commercial happened, and here I am. But that's crazy how that caught on.
Dude.
I still get that question all the time.
Incredible. Oh, and Dee Dee says gold. I just loved how at this point you're like, yes. It like you don't even act out anything. You're just like, yes. Is it is it annoying at this point? Like,
yeah, I'll tell you, it's yes, it is a little bit. Because I mean that's just my own thing. I got to get over that. But but what's really good about it is it's a question. So if someone had walked up and said, "Hey Hickory," you know, I just go, "What's up?" Or like "Hemi guy." But when they say, "Does that thing got a Hemi?" my brain has to answer the question. And so I'm compelled. I'm like, sometimes I like, depends on what mood I am. If I'm in a good mood, I go, yeah, man, sure does. Or if I'm in a bad mood, like, no, it does. What thing are you talking about? My penis? Yeah, I have a power penis. What so I like, I've always answered the question differently depending on my mood.
Mm-hmm.
And problem is it's a question. If it weren't a question, it wouldn't bother me so much.
Because it evokes a response. You have to say something.
Like, right.
Oh, and I'd imagine all the traveling you do, and there's times you're tired and run down, and you've got to be like, Hickory, or, you know, wow.
Yeah.
But
well, funny, Hickory used to be a punchline in my act. I used to use it as a joke or whatever. But now, because of Last Comic Standing, they showed me saying Hickory over and over again every episode. So it looked like that's all I talked about. When really that was one thing that they aired over and over again. They'd be like, "And coming up next, the guy from Hickory." You know, they would do that all the time. And so I couldn't make it a punchline anymore because people already knew about it. So then what I would do is I'd come on stage in some town, you know, in another state, and I would go, "Hey everybody, good to be here. I'm not from here. I'm from," and then do like this. And now the crowd goes, Hickory! They do it. So in a weird way, like that has totally changed. It's totally shifted. It started as a punchline. Now it's like an audience, like it's a call to action. They all do it with me. I go, yay! And then I just move on.
Oh, you get it out of the way almost. Well, that's cool.
Yeah, get it out of the way up front. And everyone's like, yay, he said it. And then I can move on.
Great. Well, yay, first off, I'm going to play the applause sound effect. Yay for all that you said today, John. You killed this, and you were more than generous with your time. So this is a show all about, like, comedy education and helping comics and all that. So the final thing is, like, is there any advice you've learned over your 20-plus years of experience or anything you can kind of share with us in closing here to propel us into being better comedians?
This is a, you want me to give advice to other comedians? I would say take 2 weeks off and quit. We got enough comedians. No, I'm kidding. I love it. Go for it. If it makes you happy, go for it. I'm just trying to stay hired, man.
That's a veteran move right there. Young keep people quit. You're in the way. There's enough of us. I love that.
No, look, I don't know. Figure out what you're good at and stay in that lane. I mean, it's okay to take risks. That's what this whole job is. But if you want quick success, I would say it's all about repetitions. The more you can do it, the better you're going to get, the quicker you'll get there. Record yourself, figure out what worked, what didn't, and, you know, have fun. And at the end of the day, please try to remember, your job is to get laughs.
Period.
Just know that. I see a lot of people not caring about that anymore, and it makes me sad. I'm like, well, this is good. I wouldn't call this a comedy special. I would call this a very informative lecture. But I didn't laugh that hard.
Any stand out to you that didn't tickle your fancy?
Well, there's a couple on Netflix that I've watched. And go like, okay, this is very informative. Like, I think this could be a good TED talk. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I'm not laughing. Like, okay, a lot of people, if you ask a lot of comedians, they'll say, who are some of your favorite comedians? And everyone will say at some point, say George Carlin, you know? And yeah, he was one of the best. He had tons of specials in his very beginning years. In his early years was very, very funny. But the older he got, the more, you know, more ornery he got and angry. And I found myself watching his last special. I found myself doing this a lot, going, oh, man, yeah, he's right. That's true. And not this. See, I want to get the laugh. So he wasn't making me laugh in the end. But I don't know. By that time, he was already a legend. It didn't matter. But I don't know. I guess I said too much.
No, it's almost like he had found his audience and could just – like almost preach to them, as opposed to like when you're younger and you're having to prove yourself, I'm sure there's a more of a fire beneath your creativity when you almost have to create success. But when you already have the success, it must be hard to withhold that standard to a degree.
Yeah, that happens. Definitely. I would encourage younger comics to go for the laughs first. And then later on, after you found your audience, then you can get lazy.
preach. All right. Yes. So get funny first, kids. Focus on getting funny first. And I'm a purist as well. Like, funny above everything is my MO. So it's so great to connect with a funny comic like you, John. If you could let them know where they can support you and follow you and all that jazz.
My podcast, if everyone would go to this website, countryishpodcast.com. Country-ish podcast. I'm very proud of it. We have new episodes every Friday. It's on Google. It's everywhere. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, iHeartRadio. Anywhere you get a podcast, it's there. It's on YouTube as well.
Yeah.
Check it out. Give it a chance and then pass it on. And thanks, buddy.
Thanks for having me, John. And I definitely think a lot of comedians have podcasts where they're just like shooting the shit with each other. But like, your approach is you're doing like an actual show production. You have a set, you have segments. Like, I think it's important for comics to look at John's approach to podcasting and treating it like an actual production and not just like a hangout session with your friends.
Yeah, those are fine. But the ones that work as hangout sessions are people who already have an audience.
Right.
You're not going to get new people listening to you, just to hang out. So, to grow your podcast, I think it would be good to have segments. I'm still trying to learn that game too, though. I can't really preach too hard about that. But I'm only on episode 21, and we're loving it, man. So I hope you guys who are watching this, give me a chance.
Yes. Go support. Go check out John. He's doing big things. So John Reap, thank you so much for being on Hot Breath, my man. Ladies and gentlemen, we will be back on Monday with a Q&A with Alonzo Bowden. So...
Oh. Alonzo Bowden was a judge on my season of Last Comic Standing. I'm a huge fan.
What? That's
yeah,
so awesome.
Yeah, tell him I said hello. Talk to him.
I definitely will. All right, Hot Breathiverse. We'll see you on Monday. Stay funny. Bye. Woo. That is what Hot Breath is all about. Hot Brethren and Sistren, a 28-year comedy vet breaking down the game like nowhere else on the internet. So if you want to get more of these interviews, subscribe to our YouTube channel, subscribe to our podcast, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Join that Facebook group. I'm telling you right now, if you're a comedy fan or a comic or aspiring comic, that Facebook group is going to have something for you, and you can join the mission of cultivating the next generation of great comics. I thank you for your valuable time. Thank you for all of you that have reached out, sharing so much gratitude for the show, reaching out to me on social media, saying, hey, I love this episode. This was my favorite tip. I would personally love to know what your favorite tip from this episode was. Let me know. I engage. I love talking to you. We are the Hot Breathiverse. We are on this mission together. So if you enjoy and are inspired by this mission like I am, share it. Pay it forward. There are ways you can support the show through getting merch or the Patreon, but a free way to support all the work going in here is to share it with a person that you think would enjoy it. And I enjoyed your time today, so we'll be back next Monday, Hot Breathiverse. But until then, I always end these episodes by thanking my wife for making the theme song, and thank you to you, Hot Brethren and Sistren, for making all this possible. I love you, and until next Monday, right here on Hot Breath. Hot Breath. This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.